Now, before Kyoto became the only environmental issue on the agenda, the Kretschmann government was dealing with a whole host of concerns, much like the one we just heard about. The prime minister came into office hot on the heels of the conference on biodiversity in Rio in 1992, and he's leaving with the legacy of the Rio Plus 10 conference in Johannesburg still waiting to be written. To assess his environmental record between those two landmarks, I'm joined now by Akash Maharaj, the Liberal Party's National Policy Chair, and Peter Tabbins, Executive Director of Greenpeace Canada. They're both in the studio here in Toronto. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. Akash Maharaj, if I could begin with you, we've been hearing so much about Kyoto lately, but obviously the government has done more than just agree to ratify Kyoto over the last 10 years. What can you point to as the environmental legacy of the Kretschmann government?
I suppose there have been three main priorities for the government over the past 10 years. The first has been clean air and water. The second has been protection and preservation of natural spaces. And the third has been species at risk. I think it is fair to say that certainly during the first half of our mandate, because the need to wrestle the deficit under control was the overarching government priority, environmental concerns were put off to the second half of our mandate. But they have certainly accelerated over the past few years. In the most recent budgeting exercises, for example, we've committed about $1.2 billion over the next 5 years for environmental issues. You're right, Kyoto has certainly become the centerpiece of public attention. But in the lead-up to Kyoto, there were a series of steps taken. For example, the air quality agreement with the United States, which will reduce by about 90% over 10 years the amount of smog-producing emissions from tailpipes. There's been the recent Species at Risk Act. There's been the recent investments in water quality, especially in building up municipal infrastructures to ensure that water coming into people's taps is clean and water being discharged into waterways has been cleaned as well.
Peter Tabbins, what is Jean Chrétien's environmental legacy?
Well, frankly, it's a legacy of neglect. It's a decade of lost opportunities. I'd agree with Akash that in the first half of the Prime Minister's term, there was very little done, and the deficit was definitely the priority. But I would say that when you look at the second half as well, not much happened. I would say that if it weren't for Kyoto, this Prime Minister would have almost nothing to point at that he could be proud of. The World Commission on Forests and Sustainable Development in the year 2000 said that Canada was using up its forests faster than it was regenerating them. In effect, we were doing with our forests, and are today doing with our forests, what we did with our cod. In 1992, as you're well aware, people were worried about eating fish in the Great Lakes. According to the International Joint Commission, at the end of the decade, the condition of toxic contamination of fisheries in the Great Lakes was worse than it had been at the beginning of the decade. In terms of species protection, the bill that finally came out of the Commons and has not yet been enacted is far weaker than environmentalists ever wanted, and one that is significantly constrained, one that does not reflect the full power and commitment of the federal government. When environmentalists talk about Jean Chrétien's legacy, it is one of neglect, of lost opportunities, and it's an unfortunate reality.
We began this by talking about the conference that Jean Chrétien began immediately afterwards, the conference in Rio, and I'd like to go back to that now. Akash, if I could begin with you, how much of what was promised in 1992 has been delivered in the 10 years since?
At the Rio conference? Across the world, the results of the Rio conference have been dramatically disappointing. Amongst industrialized countries, the record has worsened rather than improved. But, for example, with the Kyoto Protocol, that is one of the reasons why we are agreeing to peg what we will achieve, not to reductions based on the situation as it is today, but the situation as it was in 1992. The intention, of course, is to ensure that we not only improve the situation from its current state of affairs, but reverse the decline that has happened over the past 10 years.
Why, particularly in Canada, why has nothing really substantial happened post-Rio?
I believe the pattern is the same both in Canada and in most G7 countries, and that is that when the Conservatives acceded to Rio, and when all industrialized countries acceded to it, there was much fanfare. The targets were ambitious, but there was very little sense that there would be consequences for a failure to meet targets. And in politics, as in life, if there are no consequences to failure, then failure is inevitable. As a result, one of the commitments the Prime Minister has made in the ratification of Kyoto is that it will be enshrined in national legislation so that there will be consequences both to government and to private actors for failing to meet those targets.
Peter, why haven't there been political consequences to failure? Why don't Canadians feel as strongly about this as they apparently feel about deficit reduction, for an example?
Well, to some extent, it reflects the fact that the environmental community has not had the money to put into editorials, ad campaigns, and other forms of public relations to move public opinion. Let's face it, there was a huge drumbeat from the private sector in the early 90s around deficit reduction. But people do care about the state of the environment. They care about the air they breathe. They care about the water that they drink. And I think that the fact that we are seeing Kyoto coming forward in Canada, the fact that we're seeing it come to Parliament, reflects an analysis of where the Canadian population is at. They're tired of lack of action on cleaning up the air and dealing with this global problem. I don't think there's any question that although the populace as a whole doesn't have access to media to put its case the way Business Council on National Issues have, or the CME or the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, they've made it known in polling that they want action, and the fact that politicians are moving on Kyoto is an indication of that.
I have to say that for Greenpeace to argue that it doesn't have access to the media does defy recent history. But moreover, the fact is that the Prime Minister, the current government, is, I would argue, ahead of public opinion on this. The Prime Minister is entering his final year in office. It would have been easy for him to, and as you know, from a cross-political perspective, the Liberal Party has always had the greatest difficulties with, our greatest electoral difficulties with Western Canada, the area where the political perils of a commitment to ratifying Kyoto is the greatest. The fact that we've made this commitment now and have made it unambiguously, we've not just said that we're going to accede to it, we've said that we're going to ratify it by the end of this year, and moreover, the Prime Minister could also have invoked the royal prerogative to sign this. This is an international treaty. Constitutionally, the Prime Minister has the authority, acting as the Queen's representative, to sign it without referring it to Parliament. The fact that he has referred it to Parliament, has insisted that there be a national debate on this issue and insisted that it have the imprimatur of the democratic process, I believe shows a great deal of courage, but also, more importantly, a desire to raise the profile of this issue. You asked earlier why Rio failed. One of the reasons why Rio failed was that it was conducted through executive federalism. It was conducted through a process where there were men in suits behind oak tables signing documents with fountain pens. There was no real public engagement, and there was certainly no engagement of Parliament. By ensuring that this goes through the mechanism of Parliament, it not only ensures that Kyoto will be binding on the government of Canada, but more importantly, it raises the issue in the minds of Canadians and makes it impossible for anyone to back out.
Well, actually, I would say that the reason that there was so much difficulty with the implementation of Rio was both because there was a lack of targets and timelines, and frankly, it was the United States that fought hardest against that. And Canada, in Johannesburg a few weeks ago, when I was talking to the Canadian team, were fighting against targets and timelines as well, continuously, making it impossible to put governments to account. It was extremely frustrating. I think that you are discounting the impact of the business lobby in this country and frankly around the world. They have fought tenaciously and are fighting today tenaciously to stop governments from taking action on Kyoto and other pressing environmental issues. I think that's why we've had problems with Rio, not a lack of public concern, but a mobilization of special interests to make sure that environmental protection does not get in their way.
I have to say, I have never seen a private sector organization that was anywhere near as sophisticated in mobilizing public opinion as the environmental lobby. But having said that, let me make one thing perfectly clear. Though the heavens may weep, we will ratify Kyoto.
Let's talk about some of the other elements. It is so difficult to get off Kyoto for very long when we're dealing with the environment these days.
It's true.
But there are a couple of other specific things that we touched on briefly. There's the Species at Risk Act, which, as you say, still hasn't, I think it's with the Senate now.
That's correct.
Still hasn't received royal assent. Akash, why has this taken so long?
Largely because of the beauty of the democratic process, I would say. The initial bill that was going through on species at risk was substantially, I'd say, weaker than the bill that was finally passed. And it was largely through the action of backbench MPs who stepped up to the plate, who insisted that changes be made, that the process was slowed down, but more importantly, that the process was improved.
Peter, you still feel it's weak. Why?
Yeah.
Where are the weaknesses?
Well, first of all, it only applies to federal lands. It isn't something that covers all of Canada. And you're talking about protecting about a third of the species in Canada that are at risk, not all of them. The reality is most provinces have much weaker legislation. This legislation is not dealing with habitat, which is the key issue. If you destroy the forests, all the forest-dwelling organisms, plants, animals are gone. If you destroy the oceans and the habitat at the bottom of oceans where fish breed, you destroy those species. This act is, I guess one would argue that it is better than nothing, but it is so weak that we are not going to see the kind of protection that people expect to see. But it's extremely frustrating.
What about the other concern, Akash, I'll ask you first, expressed in the last interview on oil slicks, that even when we have legislation in place, it's so often not enforced, and if it is, it's enforced with teeth so small as to be, you know, barely noticeable to the companies that are breaking these rules.
And Peter raised the question of why it is that in this first action at one species of risk, we have restricted ourselves to Crown lands, to federal lands, and one of the reasons is precisely that issue. The ideal way of bringing power into disrepute is to claim power and the capacity to do all sorts of things which one is then not able to deliver on. By having this first step restricted to Crown lands, we guarantee our ability as a federal government, as the steward of those lands, to enforce the laws that we pass. My hope is, and I believe the hope of the Liberal Party, is that after this experience and after this process has matured, it will be possible to expand the species at risk legislation and similar legislation. But for the time being, if an environmental commitment is to be meaningful, if it is to have the effect of increasing rather than reducing public confidence, it must not only look good on paper, it must be enforceable.
Peter Talbot, well, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, I am shaking my head because, in fact, you already have powers under the Canada Parks Act to protect public parks, and yet you're allowing Fairmont Hotels to go ahead with a convention complex at Lake Louise, which the environmental community roundly condemns because we already have problems with too much congestion in Banff. Federal government is allowing Transportation Corridor to go ahead in Wood Buffalo National Park, directly contrary to statements made by this government saying that ecological concerns would be the primary concerns in national parks.
I want to talk about national parks because back, I believe, in 1992, Canada promised to have one national park for each of the natural regions in the country. How are we doing there, Peter?
Well, we haven't met that commitment. At Johannesburg, the Prime Minister reaffirmed the commitment. Shortly afterwards, Sheila Copp said, well, we'll meet that commitment as money is made available in the federal budget, which is essentially the position that we've had for the last decade.
Okay.
But we have made progress on this. I mean, for example, we've created Canada's first maritime national park, our first national park in Canada's oceans. We have made progress, and to use Trudeau's phrase, don't compare us to the almighty, compare us to the alternative.